When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. Scholarly communication is an open and ongoing conversation about how communication does knowledge. The premise of the podcast is this: communicating is not a transferring, as if knowledge might be vacuum sealed and delivered, totally conserved, brain to brain. No, the premise of the podcast is that research communication is a place in time where people meet to represent and to recreate the things they claim to know. Communication is meaning, as knowledge is too, and meaning is not something that we send or receive, it is something that we make. I'm your host, Daniel Shea. I invite you to listen to authors of research, to editors at journals, to scholars who ask just how it is that the words of science make known the world we live in. My guest today is Brandon Brown, professor of physics, University of San Francisco. Brandon is the author of Planck, Driven by Vision, Broken by War, and he has written for Slate, Smithsonian, and Scientific American. Brandon is a senior writing coach for the Strictly Speaking group, and he is the author of the book which will make the center of our talk today, Sharing Our Science, How to Write and Speak STEM, published by MIT Press in 2023. So let's begin today's episode. Brandon Brown on Scholarly Communication. Hi, Brandon. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Daniel. Very happy to be here.
I think I'm going to probably begin with you today because, I mean, if I take just the first chapter of your book, it is called Me, You, and This Book. And the reason I draw attention to that is because you enter this book, which, as I said, is going to probably form the core of our discussion today, Sharing Our Science. You enter your book in a way that probably many readers wouldn't be familiar with in a writing guide. But you do it very effectively. So I'd like for you to share with the listeners what brought that about and how you would describe your presence in the book.
Sure. Thanks, Daniel. It started out as me trying to create a sort of user's manual, a user's guide, because I was hoping to provide something that would help everyone from students of science, people in their training years, all the way to more senior people who maybe were in more scientific administrative positions, and people could pick and choose different parts of this book. So I have the 13 chapters that are meant to stand alone but work well together, I hope. And I had several voices pushing me after early drafts to make it more personal. And the idea is, especially MIT Press said, well, you've worn all these hats, Brandon. You've been a fundraiser, you've worked in the nonprofit sector, you've been someone in the dean's office, and worn these various hats, and that could really flavor things and make the text even more engaging. So I eventually was reluctant, but I eventually embraced that. And as the book's later chapters lay out, we are a storytelling species, I believe, and I think a lot of research supports. And in that case, there is the message of great importance, but as primates, we also really look at the messenger. Who is the messenger? Should I trust them? Should I accept this offering from them, and with what caveats? So by introducing myself in a little detail and my aims, I thought that was sort of honest to the approach of the book, sort of living the example of part of what I'm trying to convey as a message to my fellow scientists and engineers.
Yeah, this idea of message and message received or not and messenger, which is you in this case, is something that you pick up throughout the book right early on in the exact same chapter we're talking about where you write, and I find this also from my own experience very true, where you write, "In science, we focus intensely on our message, but at the crux of human communication sits the interplay of the messenger with the intended recipient." So I imagine, that's the end quote, I imagine it is this idea that you're actually talking about right now and part of the motivation for bringing yourself more into the book than people might expect.
Absolutely. Yep, sort of an authenticity. But I also wanted to use a personal voice. And I think in the reviews of the book I received so far, I was very heartened by one that said, you know, it's as if Brandon is in the room with you. And that's mission accomplished in a way. I wanted it to feel conversational and approachable.
It certainly is. I mean, I would entirely agree with that review. It's a fun read, and it does sound like you're there, but you also make, let's say, functional use of your presence. I mean, just as one particular example, which I found quite effective, was the way you headed off one of the chapters there, audience, which, you know, keeps us within this theme of message and messages and so on, where you talk about the failed pitch for the Integrated Science Center.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, it was cringy. I certainly was there feeling it as, oh, God. But what you bring from that is what's really useful. I mean, you write again, and I'm a brief quote, "Your readers deserve VIP seating in your mind before the communication. Focus on the poor sods who will read our words or listen to them." I mean, this is excellent advice, beautifully illustrated, though.
Thank you, Daniel. That's a true story. When we needed a new science building in the worst way, and I was the academic lead on the project. I was the associate dean, a deanlet, as I say, representing the sciences and talking to architects and then out talking to potential funders. And I came to that task convinced that enthusiasm and message would lead the day. So the fundraisers would introduce me somewhere, and I would be the dog or the pony in the dog and pony show, let's say. And I just quickly realized that the best fundraising, indeed, was what my father used to call two ears, one mouth. That our species was actually geared to listen more than we talk, given the chance, and that I needed to focus on one person in those key fundraising meetings, and that was the potential donor. What were their passions? Was this project even right for them? Or what part of the project would most interest them in their background? And that sounds so incredibly obvious as I say it, I believe, but I feel like in my scientific training, and a lot of our scientific training, we don't necessarily get that sort of compassion for the audience or the reader drilled into us. So I did. I had a number of ineffective, I would call them, fundraising meetings where I had built a beautiful 5-minute talk full of images of the new building, renderings of what it might look like. And then, as I say in the book there, just long pauses with the ice settling and the pitcher of water on the table. So yeah, that was authentic and not exaggerated.
But it, again, as I was saying, brings home the message about message, to make it a little bit awkward. And that is, again, you know, you write, we focus intensely on our messages and science. And you just also referred, and this is one of the unique things that you have to offer as author of a book like this, which is why I understand MIT and their want, you know, the desire to sort of pitch the book in this way, because you are a scientist. You are also a science writer, right? Publicly and so on. So you see quite a lot about the way communication is done. But my listeners will know I work together helping scientists write. And this intense focus on the message is sort of A, what they're trained to do, and B, what they naturally do. So what you're saying is so obvious, you know, in that pitch moment, is not obvious to so many other people, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I want to say I've always been so interested in writing. And as you know from the book, I as an undergraduate and graduate student, I was taking all kinds of fiction writing workshops. And then I actually took a year of journalism training and science writing. But even then, it took, I was well into my professor days when I was writing a grant proposal and suddenly realized, wait, this doesn't have to be a completely different activity. On the other side of campus, people seem to really care about where the reader is, what the reader's questions might be, why would they be interested? But here I am writing, in this case, from a physics silo to a granting agency and all these poor grant reviewers. And I was just focused intensely on my logic and my interests without having a sort of necessarily a value proposition or some engagement or some idea of like, why are they going to read the next paragraph? What's going to hold their interest? Or how could I make this easier on them? Let's make maybe the, like I do in a fiction workshop, shorter sentences would be a little more gentle for their journey and help them keep turning pages. So it took me quite a while, despite the training, to realize there might be some happy overlap or some way to port just a few bits from those writing workshops into my scientific work. And I do think it really helped the grant funding rate, et cetera.
I mean, this is one of those things that you certainly address in the book and that anyone who works together with scientists helping them write always addresses is the value in good communication. And your focus on message and audience and readers and so on, I think brings out another aspect which isn't always brought to the fore. And that's the idea that, yes, as you know, let's say in a research article, so scientist to scientist communication, which is very much covered in your book, it's clear that the person writing it, the person who's done the study, is going to know the ins and the outs. But it's not given, and I don't think this is made so apparent to everyone, it's not given that they're going to understand the full significance of it. And that discovery of the full significance of what they've done only will come about through good communication. If they lock up their findings with the community's way of thinking, all of those readers have the possibility, and this is done through citation, of noticing what it's really worth.
Right. That's an excellent point, an excellent way of putting it. I do share with the readers of this book some research showing, and I know you're familiar with this, Daniel, that the more simply written a paper is, and we have algorithms to sort of quantify this basic reading level complexity of the sentences and the size of the words, etc., the more readable the manuscript, the more often it is downloaded and cited to get, you know, directly to your point, to broaden its impact in the community and readership. As you mentioned, and I didn't really point out, that's a great point, to send ripples and realize implications that a given scientist may never have considered.
I mean, it's what the publication, in a sense, is for. Now, again, something mm-hmm. that I feel is lost, because I mean it has an idealistic turn to it, for sure. You know, I mean, publication is immediately for people, you know, are advancing their career, trying to make tenure, wanting to just get results out and move on to the next project. There's a long list, for sure.
Yes.
But I mean, you know, the uptake by readers and what they can understand, which you didn't notice, is, yeah, to repeat myself, going to happen through, you know, solid communication, which your book offers, you know, so many different tools for creating.
Thank you.
Speaking of which, though, I mean, back to the sort of the book genesis. I have a lot of quotes because, I mean, I suppose this is certainly worth emphasizing for listeners that the book is well written. I mean, that's clear, Brandon, and it's fun to read. And
great.
there's lots of good things to quote from the book genesis. I mean, wonderfully put. I like it.
Great.
As you're saying, right, you're shooting for a pretty broad audience, typically scientists, science journalists may also be interested, but you really were interested in, you know, the student, the person in training, maybe the postdoc, and perhaps even the senior scientist. So that's certainly a targeted audience, but on the other hand, a broad audience as well,
yes,
because of the differences in career. So tell me a bit more about who you want to reach and in which way.
Right. Thank you, Daniel. The book really did come about, I was working with Strictly Speaking Group, this consulting group where, especially in Silicon Valley, we're sometimes deployed into the workplace, maybe via online chat, maybe in person, to help working scientists and engineers with their communication. And I was helping a person who had been told, this brilliant physical scientist, actually, working on technology in Silicon Valley, and she had been told that her reports were hard to read and that her workplace emails tended to inflame situations and make people angry. We were working a lot on her communication and sympathizing with the reader and whatnot. And she said, "Oh, this is working really well for me, Brandon. I would love to have just a little book I could set by my computer." And I told her, "Oh, I'll find you 5 or 10 books. There's so many great writing books." And I did find some old favorites, but I found I couldn't locate anything from a scientific point of view that targeted working scientists. There was plenty of stuff for, hey, do you want to be a science journalist or general academics, maybe, et cetera. So I tried to write into that space. So really, anyone working with technology or on the academic, physical and life sciences, certainly. I think students, and I found this already, have been kind of running around giving talks at various universities and institutes, and found that the trainees are the most eager to hear about, think about, and talk about these things. And that this more senior scientists are sympathetic, but maybe less likely to dig into their own draft emails and try to apply any of it. And that's absolutely fine. But I did consider a broad funnel, but I think it might have most of its impact, as you say, with trainees and students.
Yeah, and this is a question that drives me professionally and also through this podcast of, and it's something that your book certainly points to, because you have, a pedagogical stance. You say, "I'm into fundamental principles, which the individual can apply," right, rather than, you know, a long list of this is how you do it. And I sign up for that as well. But what intrigues me in that is, where is the balance? Because as you know, in science, we have, you know, sort of the supervision model. It's learning by training, right?
Yes.
You know, so much is done through mentoring and on-the-spot learning. So it's always this question of how much is instruction, for me anyway, how much is instruction, how much is experience? Or more pragmatically, which precise combination will bring about, you know, the more rapid and more solid advancement in somebody's communication skills or any research training? But we're talking about, you know, communication here.
No, I'm really glad you brought that up. Because rather than reading a book, which I think can help in many ways, and I toss out some exercises for people as well, but it's really doing the writing and gaining experience with that sentence by sentence, or in developing a talk point by point, slide by slide, developing that experience. So one thing I try to promote, and maybe too quietly, the most important part of what I try to do in the book is train or encourage science types to read like a writer, as some novelists put it, to approach any piece of text. We're so good at digging into a scientific text and extracting the information, and we are trained to do that. But to also simultaneously, and once you turn on this gear, you don't fully ever turn it off, but to also look at that text as a piece of communication. Like, oh, what did the author do that's working for me? What sentences are particularly communicative and which ones are confusing, and what can I notice about them? How did the author of this piece introduce the topic and engage my interest, or did they at all? So reading like a writer, if scientists start doing that, then separate from any list of advice or anything I say in any particular chapter, they can develop their own voice. And this is what works for them. And that's often going to be when they're at their most effective writing, when they're sort of emulating things they've noticed that work really well for them, if that makes sense.
It does, and it's something that you, I mean, this comes back, I find, also to education, because it's something that you follow up in the book, sort of the lab report, right? And what the lab report, I mean, the lab report is, I guess, the counterpart in the sciences to the five-paragraph essay in humanities or language arts. I mean, two ways of entirely killing the exchange and interaction that communication is meant to be are these two forms of writing. And what you're suggesting is much the opposite, right? Activate the scientists' analytical and curiosity skills and get them applying it just to the text.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you mentioned the five-paragraph essay. That that comes up a lot of all places in my consulting work, and I don't know how broadly true this might be, but in the U.S. anyway, there's sort of a ubiquitous stamp on students in their early days learning this. This is how you write a written piece of communication or a so-called essay, with an introduction, three paragraphs or three main points and a conclusion. And while it's fine to have 3 points, and that can be a better number than 17 points, the extent to which they think a conclusion is a reiterating the introduction, et cetera, is still in many technical minds as well. I do joke a lot about the lab report. It's some of the first scientific writing that most of us do as science students. But it's a particularly anhydrous, joyless exercise usually, and I think a lot of us subconsciously carry that over to the first time we start writing papers. Oh, here's the introduction. It needs to be so dry that it would put anyone to sleep, and then I'll discuss my methods, and finally some of the good stuff, maybe what I found and what I think about it, etc. So as I say in the book, I'm not encouraging revolution, but can we early in a paper or even a lab report mention that there's a surprise coming, or mention some more surprising implication of the work, or why might a mechanical engineer care about what I found in a low temperature physics laboratory? Can I engage someone else by teasing a question early in the paper? And all the editors I've spoken with at journals and certainly people in granting agencies, they really encourage this writing more than discourage it. I think sometimes as working scientists, we see the boundary conditions, the rules, as much more strict than they might actually be, editor by editor and overseer by overseer, if you will.
Yeah, it's one of those unfortunate, consequences of I find that the way writing is sometimes taught, and it applies to language arts as it applies to science. You know, the lab report and the five paragraph essay serve well here because it brings across that mentality that you're referring to, where it's more about supposed to than what I can do, and by can I don't even mean may, but What is possible here, and what am I capable of doing? What does the text afford me to do, and what is it that I need to do? These are the functional questions that make the text interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I quote a writer named George Saunders, very interesting person for us to think about. If I have this right, he had a geophysics training originally and sort of left science to pursue a very successful career in writing fiction. He's written books like Lincoln and the Bardo that are very experimental and ambitious and also beautiful. He's an acclaimed writer of short stories, has a natural sense of narrative, but he likes to think about writing. And he teaches writing, I believe, in Syracuse, New York now. He likes to think about writing as a dialogue, a sort of call and response or a question and answer ongoing with the reader. And when the writer's on top of things and functioning well, they're anticipating the next question in the reader's mind, whether it's a short story of fiction or whether it's a piece of scientific communication, and answering just enough of that question to keep that sort of imaginary dialogue going. And I think we can bring that. I talk to a lot of people who maybe are struggling with so-called writer's block. They don't like writing their first drafts. They would rather go do anything in the laboratory they can think of or go read some papers rather than starting to tap those keys with their fingers or whatever. And it's often instructive and I think fun for people to start an imaginary question and answer with an imaginary audience member. And you could make them silly. You could make them skeptical. You could pick your worst scientific adversary that you could imagine and have a Q&A with them. But it can really get you going and anticipating all kinds of questions that your readers might have.
To return again to this idea of education, because what you're talking about now makes me think of something that I also do with the scientists that I work together with, is to tell them a little bit more about grammar. And I just lost a few listeners. I'm sorry, but my actual point is that I wonder at times, and I'm also bringing this up because I mean, you give us, let's say, at least two solid chapters on, dare I say, grammar, and I think there's some value into it because what Saunders is saying, what you're talking about here, are things that show up in the sentence, right? I mean, if we take just a silly example of, you know, our approach achieves X and Y, or our approach has achieved X and Y, right? The dialogue with the reader is happening in the achieve, right? The reader is going to be saying, does it or has it? And that's, of course, two entirely different arguments that are going on between you and the reader. And when you can sort of hook that onto, you know, a verb and a verb form, then you start to really realize the significance of tenses and why we even care about them.
Absolutely. And, you know, it circles back, Daniel, to an earlier question, if I may. We're talking about, I think it's the physicist in me a little bit, but I do love the idea of universal principles that could help people with any bit of communication. But as you say, really the devil is in the details of the writing task and the experience. And early on in the manuscript, I had two bits of feedback. To your most recent point on grammar, someone thought my first grammar chapter was a little too long, and I moved a lot of the examples, the just dissecting and improving sentences, I moved some of that to an appendix. But the other point was, you know, they're very different traditions. You know, I heard back rightly from some reviewers that you can't treat a biologist and a physicist completely the same way going in. And they do face very different cultural expectations in their writing and their speaking. And that was one of the more fun chapters to add, and doing a deep dive into what linguists have found about our different writing traditions. So in the physical sciences, we might be much more likely to start a talk or a paper with a sort of take it or leave it attitude, for instance. And so maybe I'm most sensitive to that tradition and trying to soften it or diffuse it, a little bit in the book. But that's very fascinating to consider the extent to which we've developed different traditions if we're in molecular biology or theoretical physics, and down to the different color palettes of our slide presentations and what's expected, et cetera.
Well, this is, again, where the strength of your presence in the book, I find, comes out. You give us on various points throughout sort of this recurring story of the fate of one of your articles that was being questioned by the results that you had, whether or not.
Yes,
well, I'll take the anonymous name Pat that you use.
Yes,
some Pat was questioning whether or not your findings were solid, but that actually isn't the interesting part. The interesting part is precisely what you're bringing out. And I think this is something worth unpacking a bit for listeners, because it's amazing how much culture, or subculture, as you might call it, in the disciplines and in the sub-disciplines really matters to the communication. And so much work is heading in the direction of interdisciplinary. This is also something that you talk about, that this needs to be, you know, integrated into the communication. People need to realize, no, I'm not just, you know, doing what I'm supposed to and filling in the right parts of the IMRAD structure and so on. I'm actually trying to get what I understand in a format that someone else will understand. And our formats for understanding, you know, pattern differently.
Right. So the whole situation with PAT, and I would make it not about one given neuroscientist or anything, but more about sort of a cultural mismatch. And so this is, 20 years ago when I was switching over from my realm of low temperature physics, which is where I'm trained in superconductivity or whatnot, and moving over to an interesting sensory biophysics problem. And it had all this enthusiasm and all this fertile ground for cross-pollination, I thought, and was very excited about the work, but I did not study biological audiences, the audiences in sensory neuroscience and what they cared about and the type of questions they had studied. And I make the analogy in the book that I was sort of like this awkward person at a cocktail party who barges into a tight conversation and spills other people's drinks by accident and my enthusiasm to meet them, right? Instead of like learning the local flavor and lore. And I think my data in that case was being challenged more because of my clumsiness than my actual scientific work, if that makes sense. And, you know, go ahead, please.
Yeah, it does. And that's exactly the interesting point. I mean, you make this wonderful, again, the formulation is perfect. This list of guidelines, and one of them is to master the local questions. And that seems to be precisely what's going on here. I mean, this idea of, well, does the field want to find out how something works or what it does or why an effect occurs? And the interesting thing about this is, A, it's clearly useful as a guideline for crossing a disciplinary boundary, as you did. Unfortunately, you had to learn it after the fact. but it's also one way of pointing out to yourself assumptions that you're making in your own research, I think.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I had never paused to think in detail about the questions I found most interesting, and where that comes from, and if my training had some role in that. And it did. You brought up exactly these questions of how versus what. And in this case, I was studying a sensory organ, and the biologists were very concerned about understanding what it does for the animal sensibly, and had spent decades, hard-won decades, figuring this out. And in my obsession with how the organ worked, I kind of clumsily said, oh, and by the way, the organ probably can transduce this other sensory input. I was just insensitive to respecting that, oh no, we know what the organ does for the animal. I'm not challenging that, but it came across for various reasons in a way I wouldn't have intended if I had studied my new audiences more carefully. And you know, when I look back now with some long hindsight on my biophysics work, interestingly, the most cited papers, I think, are not necessarily my most important or relevant offerings to sensory neuroscience as a community, but the ones where I had finally learned some sense of audience and like, oh, yeah, I don't want to roll out these sets of equations if I'm trying to communicate in an effective way with a lifelong electrophysiologist, for example, or hear commonalities of her language that I can emphasize. And it's really true that the most cited papers from that time are the later ones where I had learned the culture better.
And I mean, what better illustration could we ask for than your own experience and your own career than for the value of communication? And And again, I would turn it back into one's own field because, you know, I've spent some time among scientists. My listeners will know my background is actually, you know, linguistics and literature, so it's not my home. But the point is that, you know, by reflecting and turning that mirror in upon oneself, one's own communication to one's own sharpens, because you realize, we are interested in how it works. That's what we do. You know,
yes.
And when you know that, you have, you know, the best of foundations to build your communication upon.
Absolutely. There's a sort of know thyself aesthetic here, right? That I don't think is necessarily part of scientific training. And we are really given this mantra that we are absolutely a logical people and objective, and we all set the data on some grand table, and people from all scientific disciplines will come up and look at the data and agree if it's good and agree on what it means. I think we have this tacit assumption, which completely runs afoul with our settings as a species and how human brain actually operates, unfortunately. Now, I think those are still, I'm not dismissing those ideals, and they're wonderful. We need to get very close to that. Being a little more self-analytical, like, where are my own biases? What have I been trained to emphasize? Why exactly am I excited about this aspect of this problem, et cetera, could really, really be worthwhile, especially when people want to cross to adjacent areas or cross these scientific boundaries, which in some sense, these boundaries between scientific disciplines are arbitrary, we could all agree, and historical, but they really, really matter in a behavioral and cognitive way.
Well, certainly. And it's also this clear-sightedness that you're pleading for there, and comes out so clearly in the book, in the same chapter there where you talk about, quote-unquote, Pat. Obviously, we're using this as an anonymous reference, where you say, while we science types, just as you were saying right now, while we science types rightly hold objectivity as sacred, we do not naturally scrutinize our lurking social reactions. We bring our own backgrounds, expectations, levels of comfort, privilege, hierarchy along with our attention. I mean, I think that this is, you know, communication 101. As you were saying, know thyself. Yes, you need to begin at the writer, for example, to be even able to put yourself in the shoes of the reader.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Just as an example of our biases, in some cases, privileges and lack thereof, you know, I use the example of Pat in the book, and I run into some colleagues of this anonymous Pat neuroscientist at a conference who admit that they've signed on to Pat's way of thinking just because they trust him deeply. And they haven't read my work, but if Pat says my work is suspect, then they believe him. And while at the time, as a younger scientist, I was a little horrified by that. Like, what do you mean? You're not just looking at the data? You're not even reading the work? I've come to see that I've also benefited from those same sort of non-ideal primate behaviors. Even in the reviewing of this book, which you've just read, Daniel, I heard from a sort of long-lost physics friend who said, hey, I just got a copy of your new book from MIT. What do you want me to say about it? Right? So that's really non-ideal on the other side of the spectrum. I said, please, please just read it and be as honest as possible with them. And don't worry about what I would like you to say about it. But, you know, clearly I benefited from someone knowing me. In that case, I was the Pat, and this person just trusted me and wanted to support me. So it does cut both ways, certainly. I dig into that a good bit late in the book.
Right. And speaking of groups and cultures along these lines, let's also briefly touch upon the culture that is not from an English-speaking region of the world, the culture that is perhaps also not Western. You have some interesting things to say there as well. Another person who appears throughout your book is your wife, and she happens to be in the biological sciences, so some of her lab and also colleagues show up as well, which gives the book its broad appeal, right? I mean, because we're really getting the different types of scientists asking different types of questions. And they are in that chapter where you talk about, you know, scientists who are not using, who haven't grown up speaking English, to put it as plainly as possible. You have one colleague of your wife's, I believe, Jui Lin, who is there encouraging English learning scientists to embrace a process more than a goal. And that was one of the lines, one of the many lines in the book that I underlined, because for me, and this is something I've explored often on this podcast, we're not dealing, when we talk with science and writing for publication in English, with the English that people are aware of or think of when they think of the language learning classroom. We're in a different scenario because of purposes that are involved. Could you speak a little bit to Jui Lin's comments and your views there on English and the science publishing?
Sure. I like you, just really love that response from her. She's so gracious with her time, and she's an incredibly successful scientist who, when she came to the United States with her husband from China, and they both entered scientific careers, they said they would sit in their grad school lectures and maybe understand a few sentences early on and then just get lost. It was just a jumble, a sort of, you know, picture rapids in a raging river. And the words were coming so fast, and the English language just coming from this blathering professor. And I think some of us, who are more comfortable with the English language, you know, can really take that for granted. In the United States alone, if I understand the statistics, about 40% of our grad students and postdoctoral trainees have not come to English as their primary language. So it's very important. But what I like most, perhaps, about Joe's comments, or that it applies to all of us, including, I know you embrace this, Daniel, you and I as well. I think the book makes anything clear. It's, you know, sort of a work in progress, and we're all just at different points on this, on some kind of curve through our linguistic skills in life. But I, another point I really liked is that she and her husband would sit and watch some television. And for whatever misgivings we might have about whatever's sent out as programming or the quality of that programming, what's great about that is learning sort of how people talk in a more conversational English, which I think is very, very helpful too, versus this, what can often be very stilted scientific English. So I'm not sure I'm addressing your question, Daniel, but I'm much more sympathetic than ever, having done more of a linguistic dive. I'm more sympathetic than ever at these brave folks who start a scientific career, need to learn some English, but they have to learn some specific, let's say, organic chemistry English, and then some conversational between the conference talks, schmoozing English as well. It's quite an obstacle. And I'm very impressed by so many of these people who master it so quickly.
Yeah, and I mean it's something that tears down walls but puts up barriers as well. Clearly, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
From a language like Chinese, clearly, you've got a leap to get into the way that English is structured and the way that meaning is made there, as opposed to where you're used to. But the tearing down of boundaries is, of course, the fact that everyone is using it. In a sense, it's the way chemistry thinks nowadays is in English. You know, it's an English that, you know, if you took to the streets of New York, I don't know, and not close to a university, perhaps, you know, if you showed them some of the articles, these things wouldn't make sense, right? You know, I mean, so
right.
how much of it is, and that's what I mean by the language learning classroom. I find that your comments about becoming conversational and bringing the English a bit more natural to the page is, of course, fantastic. But at the end of the day, we're dealing with an entirely separate register of the language, you know, and it's something that is learned together with the content, in a sense.
Absolutely. Now, I couldn't agree more. And we do have to honor that. You know, there are what I would call $10, $15, or maybe €7 words with five syllables that we must deploy. Acronyms that are given subfields honor, and we need to use this sort of shorthand to get our work across.
And it's also the case, as you bring up in the book, another one of those sort of anecdotal moments where before you dive into the grammar sections, right? You get one, I think one of the physicist or a chemist, no, a chemist in one of your audience says, you know, that you can't learn to be a writer, right? It's something that you have or you don't have. And it's one of these things where, you know, even somebody who grew up with English as their language and they go and they learn biology and they go into the lab and then they actually have to publish something, that first article or the first few, I mean, they're not going to be easy.
Right.
There's a steep learning curve, and it's I think a lot of those people, if you ask them, you know, so what advantage are you getting from this being the language that was spoken in your home? Well, I know which prepositions to choose. You know, I mean, like,
yeah.
What after that? What?
Right. No, it's a good point, and I remember it well. The first time I was a lead author on a paper, and how much there is a sort of imitation of the respected papers and their cadences and their ways of couching things, et cetera. No, absolutely, it's very true. And yeah, the colleague I was strolling with when I shared that conversation, I think a lot of scientists believe this. He said, "I remain unconvinced that you can really teach someone much writing." And he really felt that way after just working with his own graduate students. And I can imagine them like poring over a manuscript together and him shaking his head at things just not improving. But I do disagree with that. I think raising awareness of some key principles can really help everyone improve, all of us. Daniel, I feel like I'm a better writer by a decent margin by the end of this book than I was before I embarked on the project a few years ago.
That's fantastic to hear and really interesting and encouraging, I think, for scientists out there. Because, to close out, Brandon, this is a perfect, I think, topic to land on. One of the aims of this podcast is really to just help the research, whether it's, you know, to improve the curriculum in drastic ways or to just give somebody a hack that helps them produce better abstracts or something like that. And your approach there about, you know, use the writing, learn the writing, and raise awareness. I mean, this is taken directly. This is the word that's actually used in composition and writing studies, you know, awareness raising. That's one of the primary, or metacognition, as it might be more technically called, primary ways of getting people to communicate more by choice, figuring out what they want to do. And what you've just said there about this fact that, you know, even you could almost probably break it down chapter by chapter, you felt yourself becoming clearer. I think what's going on there is somewhat, I think this is a very important point. People focus in on the language. You know, we were talking about foreign language, people who didn't grow up speaking English. But a lot of the difficulty in communicating something is getting to know that something right and well and knowing what you want to do with it. And all of that is, in a sense, language independent until you actually start writing the sentences, right?
Absolutely. So beautifully said. And to sort of circle back on that, now that I think about it, and I've seen so many different scientists and communicators, including Nobel laureates to grad students having a really hard time with their English, there is some people do have a much better sense of audience early on, and maybe that level of compassion is something that comes more naturally to some than others, obviously. And in that sense, our own, it's independent of our linguistic skills or linguistic traditions. And it has such a central role in effective communication. It's just that compassion with whoever's trying to receive our message.
Well, thank you very much for that, Brandon. That is Brandon Brown. And we talked today about his book, Sharing Our Science, How to Write and Speak STEM, with MIT Press in 2023. And we talked also generally about communication. Thanks to you too, my listeners. Bye-bye. And until next time here on Scholarly Communication.